This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. The U.S. and Cuba may have embassies in each other's countries today, but relations are far from normal. Human rights, basic freedoms, and an open economy continue to be major areas of friction between the two countries. Now, for the first time, negotiators tackled the contentious issue of reparations this week. American companies and Cubans in America want billions of dollars for property confiscated two generations ago when Fidel Castro and the communists seized power. Homes and businesses, shops, factories, farms, sugarcane fields, they were all just taken by the revolution. Meantime, Cuba claims America owes it billions of dollars for the crippling effects of more than 50 years of the trade embargo. The Brookings Institute examined almost 6,000 certified U.S. claims. The author of that report, Richard Feinberg, figures Cuba can afford the payback if the estimated $2 billion of claims are stretched out over years.
So we had a tough policy for 50-plus years, and how many claims were resolved, Michelle? How much did the claimants get back in 50 years? Zero. So that might suggest that a different approach might at least gain something for the claimants. The so-called tough policy got them zero. So anything they gain from this new approach would be more than they had gained from our full-court press embargo.
So is there a reasonable chance that Americans eventually could recover something after a half century? Did your family leave behind a home, a factory, a farm? Would that make you feel whole again? Let us know as we begin the Florida Roundup here. Cuba and the United States and reparations. 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. Of course, all over social media on Twitter, at WLRN, and facebook.com/group/TheFloridaRoundup. Tim Padgett is with us, covering the Americas for us here at WLRN, and in Havana, Daniel Trotta, chief correspondent for Reuters in Cuba. Gentlemen, both of you, welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Tim, are these talks really meaningful, or are they just for show?
No, they're meaningful because this is really a linchpin of the whole normalization process. Really, if you talk to most analysts, they'll say that normalization really can't get done unless two items are really taken care of here. One is this, getting this dispute about what Cuba owes U.S. companies and individuals for what they seized during the early days of the revolution. And the second thing is the trade embargo. Mm-hmm. Unless the United States eventually eliminates the trade embargo, then normalization really won't make any progress either.
Daniel Trotta, Reuters in Havana. Are these talks registering at all with Cubans in Cuba?
I don't know that they are so much with the average Cuban, but certainly with the government. And to reiterate Tim's point, it is taken very seriously here. And in all fairness, too, Cuba has always said it would compensate people whose property was nationalized and fully intended to. In fact, Cuba did compensate those from other countries who had their property nationalized. But what happened back in 1960 is that the U.S. cut off the sugar quota, and relations went sour from there. So Cuba has always recognized that this is an important step that it has to take.
America has accepted other countries nationalizing properties, and they've accepted that in exchange for some compensation. And Cuba, Daniel, as you mentioned, has essentially accepted that, yes, they probably do owe some people, some companies, some money. So now we're just trying to get to the devil in the details, Tim.
All right. What you're seeing now in this early step here, and the talks just started on Tuesday in Havana, is that the United States is presenting about 6,000 claims from companies and individuals, equaling about $2 billion. Mm-hmm. Or if you compound interest over the past half century, that comes to about $8 billion. Somewhere between that $2 billion and $8 billion is what they're going to come up with in terms of what Cuba should be paying back.
And to whom are these 6,000 claimants? A lot of them are companies.
A lot of them are companies, and actually, companies only represent about 1,000 of those 6,000 claims, but those claims represent $1.5 billion of the $2 billion that we're talking about.
It's the biggest share. And are those companies still around? I mean, some of those are big companies. Some of them may have been swallowed up via merger and acquisition activity.
Many of them are still around. Companies like Starwood Hotels, sure, et cetera. Yeah. I mean, they're still around. A lot of companies that were particularly tourism, et cetera. But, mm-hmm, they're still around, and they're still wanting their money.
So, Daniel Trotta in Havana, the claims by the Brookings Institute this week was that Cuba can afford to pay these claims if they're around the $2 billion mark. Is that the the voice that the Castro regime is also speaking with?
Well, typically they don't say. They don't give out those sorts of details very often. But that Richard Feinberg study that you mentioned does say that, yes, if it is 200 million, a billion spread, or spread 2 billion spread over a year, 10 years, 200 million a year, that would be feasible. The other thing in that Feinberg study that I found was interesting is there are a number of other creative solutions where maybe it's not just cash payments, that Cuba could offer some joint venture deals for these companies if they're interested in investing in Cuba, that perhaps the individual property owners would only be satisfied with a cash settlement. But so if some of these companies want back in, this could be an opportunity for them to accomplish some type of debt for equity swap in a company that might do business in Cuba. So it's a bit too early to just attach simple dollar figures to this. There could be any one of a number of solutions.
Yeah, I'm glad Daniel brought that up, because the Cubans and the Americans have started calling that aspect of the talks the grand bargain.
Well, what's fascinating about that is that would require the elimination of the trade embargo. These Fortune 500 companies that still have claims dating back a half century in Cuba are not about to do a debt for equity swap. But Cuba, forget about what the money that you owe us from 1960 and confiscating our hotel. We'll take the joint venture on the beachside resort today. With the trade embargo, that's a non-starter.
There are two reasons why these talks are so important for Cuba. One is that it shows to the world, if they do start making these reparations, it gives the impression that they're serious about creating an environment for foreign investment, which Cuba desperately needs. The other important factor here is that they want to use these talks as a way to leverage the U.S. Congress to get rid of the trade embargo.
So did you have family property that was confiscated back in the late 1950s, early 1960s? Would you like a cash payment? Would you like that property back maybe in the years ahead? Let us know. Join the Florida Roundup as we begin with the United States and Cuba talking about reparations. 1-800-743-9576. On the telephone at 800-743-9576. On Twitter and Facebook, look for us on social media. Let me ask Daniel Trotta at Reuters in Havana this question. The United States, the State Department and the Treasury Department that could be behind forging some kind of reparation agreement is there for U.S. citizens. Now, if a Cuban left in 1959, was run out of their property and has since become a U.S. citizen, but was not a citizen when the property was seized in Cuba, are they left out of the cold in these reparation talks?
So far, they are. The United States has really not wanted to talk about this subject very much for obvious reasons. In past situations like this, those subsequently nationalized U.S. citizens had some recourse. In Nicaragua, that was true when there was a similar situation after the first Sandinista government handed over power to Violeta Chamorro, and the Nicaraguans who had later become U.S. citizens in Miami were able to have some recourse. So far, that's not the case. If you were a Cuban at the time in Cuba and the Cuban government nationalized your property, legally the United States government has nothing to say about that. However, this is all a negotiation, and at some point I suspect the U.S. will weigh in on this, but for now they really just don't want to talk about it.
Katrina on our Facebook page asked us to clarify just this idea of claims applying only to U.S. citizens. Tim, what about those Cuban Americans that fled and have since become citizens? Is it just the matter of the moment that the property was confiscated?
Yes, this is a very fine legal point. If your property was confiscated when you were not an American citizen, as Dan just pointed out, there's not a lot the U.S. government can do. Technically, the hope is that if these talks between the companies and U.S. citizens who were U.S. citizens at the time of the confiscation, if these talks go well enough, then that will sort of pave a smoother road then for afterward the Cuban government and Cuban exiles negotiating these properties, because you're going to see, for example, that kind of negotiation going on anyway with houses, for example.
Right. Absolutely. Let's go to line one here on the Florida Roundup. Maria is joining us from Miami. Maria, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I was listening keenly, and my question is, My grandparents brought all of their documentation with them when they came. They were not American citizens at the time of the confiscation, as you just clearly said. But the main house, they have 22 properties in total, the main house has always been utilized by the Cuban government. So no family has ever used that property. It's the Cuban government took it and has had it ever since.
Maria, it sounds like you may not have necessarily a legal standing, at least initially.
Exactly,
here, Tim.
Exactly.
Yeah, even the most hardline anti-Castro politicians here in the United States have conceded that there's no way families like Maria's are going to gain full, reparation mm-hmm. for property like that. But what they're, as I said before, what they're hoping is that if they can get a good negotiation process going, that eventually they'll be able to move into talks on properties like Maria's families.
You know, and I
would also say that if they kept all their paperwork,
yeah.
and it is not a property that's been chopped up in. Dispersed to many people, there's probably a ray of hope there. It's also interesting that this other idea about, you know, bringing the Cuban American exiles and Cuba back together is going to be a huge topic going mm-hmm. forward. When Pope Francis was here, that was sort of a central message of his visit, that that these two sides need to reconcile. And, you know, once, I think down the road after the embargo is lifted, you know, once we deal with other issues like Guantanamo and the Martis and whatnot, I think that eventually there is going to have to be some reconciliation between these two.
I'm going to talk about those other issues here in a moment, Daniel Trotter from Reuters in Havana. But Maria, still with us from Miami.
Yes. And you know, I had another thought that may be pertinent at this time, and that is intellectual property. I think that's a subject that everyone discusses now. My grandfather also had pharmaceutical patents that were usurped by the government.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of reconciliation can occur, or what lessons can we learn moving forward with intellectual properties?
Great question, because we're not talking just about physical property, just about residents and businesses and factories, but what about the business and trademark properties? Daniel Trotta, you have any information on that?
Yeah, I mean, Cuba has actually respected trademarks quite well. They do have a registry here. Many U.S. companies, from Coca-Cola on down, all have their trademarks protected, and the government does do so. The intellectual property rights that's been violated has more to do with copyright, with entertainment, movies and TV shows that the Cuban government pirates. But as far as patents and trademarks, those are very much protected here.
I want to talk about some of these other issues that the Cubans are putting on the table. Yes, the big one is, of course, dropping the trade embargo, but there's other issues. Back in July, the Cuban foreign minister, Bruno Rodriguez, was the first foreign minister of Cuba to visit the U.S. State Department since 1958. Then he told U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry that Cuba expects some payback here.
The compensation to our people for human and economic damages are crucial to be able to move towards the normalization of relations.
Human and economic damages. Daniel Trotta, Reuters in Havana, what are the counterclaims that Cuba has?
Well, we've seen a number of different numbers. The one that they put before the UN every year is currently around $121 billion. I've had other figures cited to me in excess of $300 billion. I think whatever the number is, they are real if you count the embargo, and a number of other aggressions like the Bay of Pigs or the bombing of a Cuban airliner in Barbados. They have a whole list of grievances which they could put forward. And again, I think this is part of a potential grand bargain that the U.S. can solve both these problems at once by perhaps entering an agreement where it does compensate the Cuban government in exchange for the property owners receiving their compensation.
We should note that it is codified in U.S. law that in order to lift the trade embargo, according to the Helms-Burton Act of 1996, the property claims have to be resolved. The embargo cannot be dropped even by an act of Congress unless they're willing to change that 1996 law. Daniel Trotta with Reuters in Havana, thank you very much. Now, as the Castro regime sat down in Havana with American negotiators over these reparations, its figurehead, Fidel Castro, sent a letter this week to his ally and financial backer, Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela. The letter essentially congratulated Maduro for accepting defeat. Last weekend, Venezuelans turned away from Maduro and the socialist revolution led by Hugo Chavez. Instead, the opposition party won big, securing 2/3 of the seats in the National Assembly. This was the celebration in Doral Sunday night as the election results came in, showing Maduro and the socialists losing and losing big. So is this the beginning of the end of Chavismo, and how could this impact South Florida? And will this get toilet paper and medicine and food and water on the shelves in Venezuela faster? Alexandra Ulmer is a Reuters correspondent joining us from Caracas, Venezuela. Tim Padgett continues with us here on WLRN. Alexandra, what has this week been like in Caracas?
Well, it's a new political chapter for Venezuela, so emotions and tensions have predictably been running quite high here. The opposition took to the streets to celebrate on Sunday night, waving flags, uncorking champagne, etc., while the Chavista supporters generally lay low. This has shifted recently in the last days, as it seems like we're heading for a political showdown come January. So people are bracing themselves for what could be political paralysis or a very tense political situation.
Let's talk about that a little bit, Tim, before we get there. This opposition win, is it a monolith party or is this wind up being a coalition?
Oh, this is very much a coalition, and it's a fragmented one. Despite a very impressive victory, I don't think anyone expected them to get this supermajority that they got as handily as they did. But by the same token, it is a fragmented opposition, and it's going to have to show unity, not just to make its running of the National Assembly effective, but also as it moves toward a next presidential election, which could come as early as next year, and especially if there's a recall referendum that throws Maduro out of office. There's all kinds of Baroque scenarios here that we could be facing next year, but they have got to get their act together to make this work.
There's a lot of palace intrigue here, even as we move into January, Alexandra. What were those supporters of the opposition candidates essentially voting for?
They were voting overwhelmingly for economic change. People are fed up of standing for hours in line, waiting or hoping food will arrive. They're also fed up with spiraling inflation that has really hit income, especially among the poor. And that's why we saw this incredible trend of a lot of Chavista strongholds suddenly voting for the opposition, because the Chavista core is generally poor. And these are the same people who have been most punished by the recession.
And Tim, what does the opposition then need to do in the very short term? How much control, even with the supermajority coming into the National Assembly in 2016, will they have on foodstuffs and medicines on store shelves?
More than you would think. That two-thirds majority really gives them a lot more leverage than they would have had if they've just gotten a simple majority. And it really gives them more leverage in areas like economic policy. For example, you've got a country right now that's going to have 10% economic contraction this year, the worst in the world. And at the same time, 200% inflation, again, the worst in the world. This gives the opposition a chance to, as a centrist political force, to step in and say, okay, folks, we can fix this. For example, they've got to fix this currency disaster to get the Venezuelan economy back on track.
Alexandra, does this continue, speed up, or slow down the exodus that us in South Florida have experienced in terms of not only Venezuelans, but also the flight of capital out of Caracas and Venezuela into South Florida?
That's a very interesting question. A lot of Venezuelans who are fed up with Maduro's government here were saying, if the opposition doesn't win on Sunday, that's it. I'm packing up and I'm leaving. I'm joining my family in Florida, in Panama, in Colombia. There is definitely newfound hope among the opposition here, but we could also be heading into a turbulent period, which could, increase crime or lead to political unrest, as we've seen previously. So we're heading into a period of uncertainty, and it's hard to say exactly how things will pan out.
We also may see reverberations, Tim, well beyond South Florida. Venezuela sends 90,000 barrels of oil a day to Cuba. It sends 200,000 barrels of oil a day throughout the Caribbean. As the opposition takes hold of the National Assembly, it's going to give it a significant voice in terms of that oil distribution.
Right. And you're going to see less oil going to Cuba. You're going to see less oil being used as sort of a diplomatic tool, the way that Venezuela was using oil revenues under the socialists. And so, yes, I mean, it's going to be hard for poor, energy-starved economies in the Caribbean, for example. But I think a lot of them realize that they shouldn't have gotten so used to that largesse in the first place.
Alexandra, is this a smooth political transition in Caracas and in Venezuela over the next couple of weeks?
It doesn't seem like it's going to be. We've seen a fairly defiant President Maduro saying he will veto the opposition-led National Assembly's attempts to, for instance, free prisoners. And there will no doubt be a lot of resistance for the other plans that the opposition has in terms of economics, such as pressuring the central bank to release inflation figures or GDP figures, which they've kept under wraps for the next year.
But we haven't seen the kind of unrest in the streets that we saw about a year and a half or so ago.
Not at all. It's been very calm.
Yeah, but the fear being that we could, if Maduro, who has proven to be one of the most erratic heads of state in the hemisphere, if he steps forward between now and the time that the opposition takes control of the assembly next month, if he steps forward, for example, and gives himself sweeping new executive powers that would in effect neutralize the legislative branch, then you're going to see perhaps people go to the streets.
Tim Padgett watching the Americas for us here at WLRN. You can follow him on Twitter at Tim Padgett 2, digit 2 there at the end, 2 T's in Padgett. Alexandra Ulmer from Reuters, the bureau in Caracas, Venezuela, joining us via Skype. She's at Alexandra Ulmer, U-L-M-E-R. Alexandra, thank you for your time today. You as well, Timothy.
Thank you.
Still to come on the Florida Roundup, is the state of Florida purposely dropping disabled kids from a health care program? That's next on the Roundup. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. If you're a parent of a sick or disabled child, how would you answer the following question? Is your child limited or prevented in any way in his or her ability to do the things most children of the same age can do? Now, answering yes could take certainly a big emotional toll. It's an admission that your kid has special needs, doesn't fit in, isn't normal. But answering yes may open the way for financial help from the state of Florida to help pay for your kid's health care. While a judge has declared the questionnaire, including that question, invalid, a Miami Herald investigation finds it was a deliberate attempt by the state of Florida to reduce spending on the Children's Medical Services Program. The state wants to reinstate the questionnaire. Carol Marvin Miller is the investigative reporter behind this investigation with our partner, the Miami Herald, and joins us from the Doral newsroom. Carol, welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Nice to hear from you.
Thank you.
What is the Children's Medical Services?
Children's Medical Services is a program housed within the Department of Health that provides money for and direct health care to children with special medical needs or significant developmental disabilities.
Who qualifies for it?
Well, you can get in the door one of two ways. If your family is impoverished and therefore your child qualifies for Medicaid, you can be eligible that way. Another program that enables you to become eligible is KidCare, which is the state-funded insurance program for families that are not impoverished enough to qualify for Medicaid, but unable to afford private insurance.
Is this considered a state-backed insurance program paid for by state taxpayers?
Yes.
And how many kids are in the program?
There were about 70,000 kids in Children's Medical Services until the spring when the state launched this effort to cull enrollment. As a consequence of that five-question questionnaire, about 9,000 kids were purged from enrollment. Some of these kids are very sick and very disabled. We led our story with a couple of kids who are effectively blind. Mm-hmm. There are kids with cleft palate. There are kids with heart conditions, diabetes. These are very frail children, and some of them were removed from enrollment.
So 9,000 fewer kids now are part of Children's Medical Services today compared to, what, just 6 months ago?
Yes.
Now, Governor Scott has said this week that there is no moratorium on enrollment in the CMS, the Children's Medical Services.
There will be absolutely no interruption service. What ACA's been doing, I think, is been good for those that need service in our state. So, but I can tell you there will absolutely be no interruption in service.
No interruption in service. ACA, the agency the governor refers to there by its acronym, is the Florida Agency for Healthcare Administration. Carol Marvin Miller with the Miami Herald, is what the governor says true, no interruption in service?
I'm not sure that it's true. I don't think what he said was responsive to the reporting that we've done. The moratorium is another matter altogether. Mm-hmm. When the department rolled out this new screening eligibility tool. What they said was that it would take more resources than they had to rescreen the kids who were already enrolled. And so they placed a hold on new screenings. Now, you have to be screened in order to be enrolled. When medical directors from throughout the state complained about this hold, calling it a moratorium, the Department of Health repeatedly and emphatically denied that there was a moratorium. The story that we published made clear that there clearly was a suspension, right, or a hold in new screenings as the kids already enrolled were rescreened.
It's an experience that one can imagine coming from Joseph Heller, the author of Catch-22. The language here matters, but it's also the screening itself. So a hold or a suspension of the screening, but not a moratorium on the enrollment. But yet the screening is the first step to get enrolled.
There's been a lot of parsing of words, yeah, and a lot of very clever language being employed over the last several months. The bottom line here is that you cannot be enrolled unless you've been screened, and the use of this screening tool for new kids was effectively suspended. No doubt there were some kids enrolled, and their records show that, but their records also show that new kids seeking enrollment were effectively denied the only tool that could move them along.
We're talking with Carol Marvin Miller, investigative reporter at our partner, the Miami Herald, about her investigation into the state's culling of participants in the Children's Medical Services and also the suspension of the screening tool that was used for enrollment. Can parents still apply today?
Of course. What also happened is that in September, in reaction to a legal challenge, a judge, mm-hmm, suspended the use of any screening tool because it had been implemented without being formally approved as an agency rule. The Department of Health has been going through the process of implementing that thing as a rule, and the workshops or hearings have been pretty low key,
yeah,
but there is significant opposition to retaining the use of that tool in its current form. The screening tool itself isn't a problem. It was developed at Johns Hopkins as a method for stratifying kids with special health care needs. But the way Florida's been using it is not the way it was designed.
As a screening tool, per se, especially that third question that I began the segment with.
Exactly. We interviewed two of the folks who developed that screener, and they said, number one, it was never meant to be used to determine eligibility. But number two—
But yet that's how Florida was using the screening tool before the administrative judge told them to stop.
Correct. The third question, which asks parents to acknowledge that their kids are different, is a real problem. When this tool was developed, that third question was meant to add a certain small number of kids to the list of kids who qualify for special health care needs. Kids with developmental disabilities such as retardation or cerebral palsy who don't necessarily have to go to the doctor more often than other kids, but they're clearly impaired in the way they lead their lives every day. Florida turned that question on its head. And as you said, if you are a parent of a kid with special needs, it's very hard to acknowledge that your kid is different from all the other kids. At a certain level, you still hold out hope that your kid will improve and enter the ranks of what folks call normalcy. But everyone we interviewed, the folks who developed the tool, mm-hmm, the medical directors throughout the state, all said that that is a very, very hard question to say yes to.
There are real families and real kids affected by this, and I want to ask you about the story of one of them, Joey Delano Delancey Jr., in a second, Carol. But behind all of this are politics and money. The state of Florida is flush with cash. We've got a budget surplus, 100 million tourists coming to town. The state government about ready to put the gavel down for a state session in 2016 with a budget of almost $80 billion. How much money are we talking about with this CMS? And have you been able to discern what's behind this change in strategy over the past 6 months that has essentially removed disabled kids from the rolls of this Children's Medical Services?
The records that we obtained showed that in the prior budget year, the Department of Health was looking at a give or take $60 million budget deficit. But you have to remember that same year, the state of Florida realized a $635 million budget surplus, meaning the state brought in $600 million more in revenue than they had anticipated. So these cuts to a program for the sickest kids in the state occurred in a year in which we were looking at millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in unanticipated revenue. And for the upcoming budget session, the governor is recommending giving back $1 billion in tax cuts. And those essentially go to special interests. So the question has been raised, why not fully fund this program rather than tax cuts for people who are paying taxes on yachts, for example.
Is the difference between a fully funded Children's Medical Services for fiscal 2016-2017 and one that's underfunded $60 million?
I don't know the answer to that. Okay. This program for the first time was turned into a managed care plan as opposed to a traditional fee-for-service plan. And there are tremendous pressures both within the plan and from lawmakers to control costs. And that's not unusual in Florida. Florida has for a long, long time rationed care to the sickest and most vulnerable in the state. One example is a program for developmentally disabled children and adults. The money is there to allow those folks to live in the community and outside of large institutions. There's a more than 21,000 name wait list for that program. For a program that provides money for disabled adults to live outside nursing homes, give or take 30,000 names are on the wait list. Florida has always rationed care for people who rely upon taxpayers for their health care.
Tell me about the story of Joey Delanor Delancey Jr., the 7-year-old in Hollywood.
Well, Joey has a host of disabilities. He has autism, he has ADHD, he has asthma, and some other conditions as well. Joey was going to get enrolled into CMS, but his grandmother, who is his caregiver, was told that he hadn't qualified. Later, she was told that he could get in, but when I interviewed her some weeks ago, she said, well, they're telling me he's enrolled, but every time I try to access that health care, I'm told he's not. You know, I go to the pharmacy to get medication. They say he's not insured. I go to the doctor. My doctor says he's not enrolled. He was one of the kids we highlighted in our package.
And you heard from the Florida Agency for Healthcare Administration since publishing Joey's story and publishing your findings and your investigation. And the agency said no child, this is a quote, no child is disenrolled from the Florida Medicare program when they are screened out of the CMS health plan. Children receive all medically necessary services from other Medicaid health plans and expenditures are not capped. In other words, they may not be in CMS, but they have other options.
Well, that is the story that the Agency for Healthcare Administration has been saying. The folks that we interview have something different to say. We interviewed a woman by the name of Phyllis Sloyer, who had been a decades-long administrator within CMS. She ran the thing for the last 11 years that she was there, ending in 2012. And when we interviewed her, her assertion is that the kids who are removed from Children's Medical Services and then transitioned into Medicaid are not going to be anywhere near as well served as they would have been had they stayed in CMS.
And why is that?
CMS has something called care coordinators, which are the equivalent of caseworkers. Their job is to help parents navigate a very complex, very unfriendly system. CMS was designed for kids who have special health care needs and who have difficulty in accessing health care. And everyone we spoke with, including the medical directors of CMS who are there on the front lines, say Medicaid will never be as robust a program for those children.
Does the strategy that the state launched 6 months or so ago in the springtime of continuing to reduce the roles of CMS continue today?
I don't know the answer to that. While rulemaking is in place to formalize that screener, it's hard to say. There's another method that the Department of Health is proposing that would allow kids entrance into CMS, and that is their doctor can sign a form attesting that the child is diagnosed with some condition that the state recognizes as an automatic pass into CMS. The problem is that the categories of illnesses that qualify right now is limited. Autism, which afflicts roughly 1 in 60 children, is not a qualifying condition. Cleft palate is not a qualifying condition. Diabetes is not a qualifying condition.
Had they been in the past?
Well, in the past, we had a completely different method for enrolling children. We are entering right now uncharted territory.
Uncharted territory that is being watched by Carol Marvin Miller, an investigative reporter at our partner, the Miami Herald. You can see the investigation, Bitter Pill, at the Miami Herald. Carol, thank you so much for sharing your work with us here on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you for having me.
We've got plenty more to come. You won't believe how much rain we've already experienced in the month of December. I'm sure you're still trying to dry out, still to come on the Roundup. We'll be talking about the disruption and the economic damage from the rain, as well as the demand that it quenches here in South Florida. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. So we're used to being wet here in South Florida, right? But come on already. We've seen record rainfall for December. Month isn't even half over yet, and this isn't even the dry season anyway. So how much rain? Well, enough to close Zoo Miami for several days this past week. Communications Director Ron McGill told CBS4 it has cost the zoo a lot of money.
It's a devastating hit for us financially. This is our high season. November through March is the high season of attendance for the zoo. Just this weekend alone, we had thousands of people coming for corporate picnics, for birthday parties. All those things had to be canceled, so it's a huge financial hit.
It's likely to be the same for the region's agricultural industry. Tommy Vick is with V&B Farms. He says he and other farmers are watching for more damage to develop in even the next few days.
If the plant is going to die, it'll start to weep. Like the leaves will start to go down and almost look like it's melting in the field.
Weeping plants, melting leaves in the field, all because of too much rain. Jeff Huffman has watched all of it as the chief meteorologist for the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network with us from member station WUFT in Gainesville. Along with him, Cynthia Barnett, journalist and professor at the University of Florida, author of 3 books on water, including Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. So we're drying out here in South Florida, Jeff, finally, but how much rain have we gotten?
Well, in much of South Florida, especially in the greater Miami area, nearly 10 inches officially since the beginning of the month as of yesterday, 9.25 inches. And Tom, that is more rain than typically falls from December to March, that 4-month period. Yes, that is the drier season in South Florida, but that's incredible that amount of rain fell in just 10 days.
10 inches in 10 days. Why?
Well, this is the first event, and I spoke to Mike Halpert, the deputy director from the NOAA Climate Center yesterday, the NOAA Climate Prediction Center, rather, and he told me that this is truly the first event we can kind of link to El Nino in the southeast U.S. There's a tropical connection to that rain. It was just a typical front that comes through often in December in South Florida, but it stalled, and then there was this jet stream, this stronger than normal jet stream, this area of wind and moisture and energy coming across from the very warm waters of the Pacific into the Gulf of Mexico, and it linked up with that front, and it sat there for a couple of days.
Cynthia Barnett, you've written a trio of books on water, one specifically on rain itself. You know, rain is a regular part of our lives as Floridians. It often appears as a small chance of rain almost in each and every daily forecast. But even this experience really has taxed our tolerance. Why?
Yes, well, of course, it's a dramatic amount of rain, but I would say that's been part of our lives, at not only as Floridians, but from the beginning of human history. We have always watched the skies and worried about extreme weather, as Jeff says. But I would say something about the way we are viewing extreme weather in general and rains. I've been reading some of my colleagues' coverage, and I've seen some things lately, like the weather appears to be on an unprecedented climate change-induced rampage, or warming is creating an angry new world. And I just wanted to say that I think in the context of rain, even extreme rain, what we have to think about is not that the rain or the weather is on a rampage. In some of these cases, when we see extreme flooding in cities, it can be connected to what we've done as humans. Mm. So, you know, humans have sort of been on the rampage in Florida since the 1950s. Every inch of wetlands removed, every mangrove removed, is that much less space to give floodwaters a place to go, right? Yeah. So I think that's an important part of a larger conversation we need to have about extreme weather and climate. It's not nature and climate that are on the rampage.
You know, it's days like the past 10 or 12 days that we're reminded, at least here in South Florida, we're really squeezed between these two great bodies of water, the Atlantic Ocean and, of course, the Everglades to the west of us. Jeff, ultimately, though, in these conversations, when people are looking at that forecast, 10 inches in 10 days here in South Florida, unprecedented rainfall, can we attribute it to climate change?
Well, as Cynthia pointed out, you really can't, because these type of extreme events have been occurring for a while. Now, the frequency of them and the magnitude of them, I would say you could tie some of that to it. But you have to remember, El Nino, which is one of the reasons why we had the heavy rain in South Florida, El Nino has been around for a while. In fact, for centuries. It's only since 1950 that we have started to study it and understand it. And it's the single greatest weather phenomenon around the globe that has the most impact on variability in our climate or in our day-to-day weather. And you know, so what happened in South Florida, I'm not surprised by it, Tom. And I think something like that could happen in our state or in the Southeast U.S. again this winter, because El Nino is strongly tied to heavy rain in the Southeast U.S.
El Nino, warming of temperatures in the Central Pacific. But Cynthia, here in South Florida, we're a continent away from that. Isn't it just human nature that we want to attribute what we've experienced, this 10 inches in 10 days, to something? And be that either climate change or some other greater power that we don't fully maybe grasp on the human level?
We have always looked to a greater power to try to explain the rain. In fact, the very first rain god known, worshipped by humans, was a little guy named Iskr, worshipped by the Sumerians. He had a lightning bolt in his hand, and he was the god of storms and rain. But when it comes to climate change...
And noteworthy, the Sumerians were in an arid climate, too, correct?
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
They were not in subtropical...
No, they were praying for it.
Right.
That's right. And I would say that, you know, overall, when you think about whether you'd want to live in extreme rain or no rain, past civilizations have survived what are known as pluvials, really rainy times. The only thing we haven't been able to survive is no rain at all. But I would like to go back to the point about climate change. Mm-hmm. And the sort of loading of the dice that scientists talk about. So there's a lot of good metaphors for this. And my favorite one I've read recently is from Waleed Abdulati, who's at the University of Colorado in Boulder and a former chief scientist for NASA. So as Jeff says, we can't tie any one event to the larger change, because these things have happened throughout human history. There are extremes built into the system, but you can say that we've created conditions to make these kinds of events more conducive. And this is what Dr. Abdulati, this is the metaphor that I love. Mm-hmm. If you stand at half court on a basketball court and shoot 100 baskets, one or two might go in. If you take 3 steps forward and shoot another 100, 2 or 3 might go in. You keep doing this until you're under the basket and you can make 90 out of 100. You know you've increased the likelihood of making the basket as you walk closer, but you can't say you made any one basket because you got closer. And so, you know, that's the way that many scientists are telling us that we can think about climate change and these extreme weather events that are being seen around the world.
Yeah, and using that same kind of metaphor, in the very short term, Jeff, it was only a few months ago we felt we were taking a step backward from the half-court shot, making the shot even further because we were in a drought condition.
Yeah, and I must say, even if I was under the basket, Cynthia, I could only make 2 or 3. But Tom, yes, and we have to remember that okay, let's take severe weather, for example, and tornadoes. You know, we're no stranger to that in Florida. But in an El Nino, for example, we're that much closer to getting one because of the increased jet dynamics in the wintertime. So it's a 60% increase in tornado activity across the state during an El Nino winter. And the 2 deadliest outbreaks in our state's history occurred in February of 98 and February of 2007, both strong El Ninos.
So are you to say that this rainy, dry season is likely to continue with El Nino continuing?
I think so. I think we're going to have a very wet winter across much of the state. The El Ninos typically correlate to higher rainfall in the central and southern parts of the state. And then the risk for severe weather is a little more elevated in the central and northern portions of the state. And then also keep in mind, several of these strong events, such as this one, have been tied to drought, unfortunately, after the significant rainfall and potentially a greater wildfire season as well. So we'll have to keep an eye on that as we move into the spring and summer months.
Well, but first we have to get through this winter. And for those of us who moved down here from up north, Cynthia, I do remind myself and others that this kind of humidity is humidity one does not have to shovel.
That's true. I have to say I still love rain. I know you've read the book, Tom. I describe Miami as the world's greatest city of rain, and I think it is. And I have to say that I know you guys are going through a really tough time, but I would still say that I'd rather live in a place with too much than a place that doesn't get any rain at all, because it really is water that gives us life.
We've gotten 10 inches in 10 days already here in the first couple of weeks of December. Cynthia Barnett, journalist and professor of journalism at the University of Florida. The book she mentioned is Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. Jeff Huffman, also along with us from Gainesville. He's chief meteorologist at the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Thanks to both of you, and stay dry for the whale.
Thanks,
area.
Tom. You too.
Finally on the roundup today, you know, living here like we do in a subtropical climate, you would think we would do a better job of describing rain. After all, we live with the threat of sprinkles almost every day. We ought to be able to be more descriptive in our downpours. Language is a reflection of our surroundings. Words evolve and morph to help more accurately describe our place in the world. Anthropologists at the Smithsonian Arctic Studies Center have found the Inuit Eskimos have 40 words for snow. Another dialect has 53. They have even more words for ice. So surely those of us making our home here in the humidity can do better than simply rain. I think the sun's coming out again, so we're going to have to leave this for a rainy day. The Florida Roundup is produced by Julia Duba and Alicia Zuckerman. Our digital editor is Maria Muriel. Our program director at WLRN is Peter J. Maris, and our technical supervisor today has been Paul Leary. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
I wish every day the sun would shine. Take me to another place in my life. Everything is beautiful. And no one's in need. No sun.